This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week we help you catch up on some of the headlines from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, October 9th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Today's show is all about kids. Fall is typically a big time for kids. You have back to school, trick-or-treating. But of course, like everything else, the fall is looking a lot different this year due to the coronavirus pandemic. More than 500,000 kids in Pennsylvania are learning to read right now. It's a demanding task in normal times. For many kids, learning to convert symbols on a page into meaning requires incredible effort and careful guidance from teachers. And learning to read is probably the single most significant event of a child's academic career. Educators say that from kindergarten to third grade, education is primarily about learning to read. After that, it's all about reading to learn. Keystone Crossroads Avi Wolfman-Arendt has been looking into how remote learning will affect kids' reading skills, and he joins us now. Avi, welcome to Explainer.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you help us understand just how important reading is for a child's education?
Yeah, I think arguably reading is the most important academic skill that you learn in school. And that's simply because if you can read, it opens the door to every other subject area, even math, when you get to things like word problems. And if later on in your academic career you miss something, let's say like, you know, you have a bad semester in English class in 10th grade, if you know how to read, at least conceivably, right, you can make that up down the road later in your life because you have the essential tool, reading, that allows you to access all that subject material. If you can't read, there's sort of a spiraling effect downward. It becomes harder to do everything else, even if you're really good at math, even if you have an innate understanding of English literature and themes. It's hard because you can't do the basic thing that allows you to sort of open the doorway to that subject area. And there are some pretty startling statistics showing that, you know, if you can't read by the time you finish third grade, for instance, your likelihood of dropping out of high school is exponentially greater.
What are the challenges presented by online learning when it comes to reading?
I think in some ways they're just the challenges presented by online learning. So it's harder, a lot of people think, to just to engage students. There's technical barriers, right? So some students have poor internet or they have computers that don't work particularly well or maybe even in some cases don't have computers at all. I think the other thing that makes reading hard to do sort of in an online environment is that it's something that a lot of experts agree really requires like explicit instruction from the teacher. So if that instruction is like disrupted or sort of reduced or watered down in any way, it's really, really important. What parents really can't do or they're not trained to do is sort of the explicit phonetic instruction that allows students to sort of start down the pathway of reading and eventually become, you know, reading experts. And so you really do need sort of that teacher interaction, that teacher instruction to make that learning happen. And I think we're in a time right now where that teacher instruction is just harder to do.
One of the things we've talked about several times on this show is that there's going to be significant learning loss due to the pandemic. And people are particularly concerned about widening gaps between children who maybe, in this context, may be natural readers or have additional support at home or whose parents have the resources to get them a tutor or things like that, and kids who maybe will struggle a little bit more with reading or kids whose parents don't have the resources to supplement that online education or make sure that they're engaged in the classroom. I mean, is that something you heard during your reporting, concerns about the way that this gap could be widened specifically when it comes to reading?
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I heard was that, you know, even if in the end we sort of find out that the overall learning loss isn't as big as feared, you know, when you sort of average everyone out, even in that sort of optimistic scenario, we expect to see a larger spread, like a larger variance, just because, like you said, there are students who have resources at home and there are those who don't. There are those who are natural readers and those who aren't. And by that, I mean, there are students who, even without that explicit instruction that I was talking about earlier, that phonetic instruction from their teachers, they're probably going to be okay. They just need less of that. just sort of the way their brains work. And there are some students who are equally bright, but they just need that instruction more. And so if they're getting less of it, you're just going to see a natural gap start to widen. And that creates an interesting issue for schools when this is, quote unquote, all over, right? Which is that they're going to need to really try to figure out, like, where are individual students at? Just because you're in third grade doesn't mean you're reading at a third grade level. And we never assumed that, but you're really going to have to drill down to see, like, all right, what does this student need? And try to sort of, you know, backfill that as much as possible.
What kind of tools or strategies do educators have or are they looking for to address these issues?
I think part of it is the diagnostic thing. It's just like we're going to have to be more sort of intentional about finding out where students are and like how much have they regressed or not progressed. I think one thing that I heard about in reporting this was trying to use this time to figure out what types of like supplemental digital tools work best. So there are programs that helps teachers create individualized lesson plans based on sort of like diagnostic testing feedback for students. And I know of one large charter network in Philadelphia that's test driving that. Maybe that becomes a solution. There are sort of very, I would say, scientifically designed or research-informed reading games that like students can do at home either by themselves or sort of more likely with the help of a parent or guardian. And there's a study out of Yale University of Connecticut looking at right now, like how effective is that in preventing reading loss in a virtual environment? And when we go back to normal school, some of those virtual solutions, they don't have to go away, right? Like we can still use some of that stuff in a supplemental way, and that might be helpful for helping students catch up. And so I think the hope is that right now, the sort of the silver lining perspective of this moment is that, yeah, maybe the instruction is not going to be as great, but we might, you know, stumble upon some things that we can use to help students catch up.
Avi, thank you so much for your reporting on this topic.
Thanks for having me on.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
Following the news out of D.C., this election season is one wild ride. This past week has been no exception. I'm Rose Scott from WABE in Atlanta.
And I'm John Dankosky with New England Public Media. Join us for a special new series, America Amplified, Election 2020.
In a time focused on the candidates and the latest polls, we want to focus on you.
It's America Amplified, Election 2020. Your voice counts.
Since the beginning of September, 300 children in Allegheny County have tested positive for the coronavirus. While severe COVID-19 illness among children is uncommon, dozens of kids statewide have experienced multi-system inflammatory syndrome, a rare but serious complication of the infection. And officials warn that even children without symptoms can spread the disease to vulnerable populations like their grandparents. Here with more is WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden. Sarah, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, Liz.
Do we have a sense of where these children are contracting the virus? Is there any sort of pattern that public health officials can point to?
Dr. Deborah Bogan, the head of the Allegheny County Health Department, didn't really get into what case investigation data revealed, though previously she has addressed daycare, saying that while there has been some transmission at childcare facilities, it's been minimal. Also, so far, 14 kids in the county have been hospitalized due to COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, but only one of those hospitalizations occurred since the start of September, meaning that the majority of those hospitalizations occurred before schools reopened. I also have heard people express confusion as to why we have pediatric cases, since you don't often see toddlers at bars or house parties. But it's actually really simple. Kids don't exist in a vacuum, and their caretakers don't either. So the more virus that circulates in our community, the more likely it is that we will have pediatric cases.
So these numbers come as Governor Tom Wolf relaxes limits on crowd sizes statewide. Can you explain the changes and the administration's reasoning for relaxing the rules?
Wolf called this a gradual adjustment that made sense as we learned to live more safely with this virus during the pandemic. So these new rules, instead of a one-size-fits-all hard limit where you are only allowed 25 people for an indoor gathering and 250 for an outdoor gathering, these new rules are a sliding scale that are based on capacity. a lot of people consider this to be a more nuanced approach because different venues and different settings present different levels of risk.
Now, I know you've talked with several infectious disease experts and epidemiologists about this week. How are they feeling about these changes?
The general sense was that they thought these rules made sense, but they cited the fact that ventilation is a key component when it comes to the risk of a setting. So, for example, these rules don't really address how well ventilated a building is. And so two spaces that are relatively the same size, but one is better ventilated than the other, would have different levels of risk. Also, when you're talking about outdoor spaces, perhaps a stadium, there's still the risk of certain points. Like if, you know, a stadium can hold thousands and thousands of people, but if everyone's entering and exiting through just a couple points, then there's a really big risk for transmitting the virus. So while they think these rules are improvement, they still encourage a lot of caution and thought for event planners and hosts, that the more people at any one place, the more likely you will encounter someone with the virus and get sick yourself.
You talked to one epidemiologist who had a really interesting take, and he was saying that when crowd limits are really strict and when they're lower, you're sort of driving some of the sort of social gathering activity underground, and that opening up a space like Heinz Field, for example, might encourage people to just go to the game in this open air atmosphere instead of hosting another family or a few friends to watch the game in their home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So this gets to the concept of harm reduction, which is something that is talked about extensively in the addiction medicine field. Basically, instead of asking people to have a sort of zero tolerance approach to all risky behavior, you give people options to do certain things that incur some risk, but overall are less dangerous. So for example, if people want to watch sports, allow them to watch sports, but give them a setting that maybe is outdoors and where they can space, which maybe that means allowing people to watch Steelers games because people are going to watch Steelers games, but maybe they can watch them at the Steelers stadium instead of in a crowded basement. This pandemic is going to go on for a while. People are feeling the effects, and there are real mental health consequences for asking people to stay isolated for a really long time. So allow them to participate in important cultural and social activities like sports, like going to concerts. People will be getting together and socializing. It is human nature and it is healthy. So instead of saying that all these things are just totally not okay and, you know, you just have to stay in your house for another 6 months, the idea is to figure out a way to allow people to do these activities more safely.
Sarah, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
StoryCorps, together with 90.5 WESA, is bringing people together for a different kind of dialogue this summer. It's called One Small Step, a project that pairs strangers who don't see eye to eye for a conversation. The goal? To share and listen to the stories behind each other's values. Sign up at wesa.fm/onesmallstep. StoryCorps' One Small Step is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
This year was going to be the ultimate Halloween. It's on a Saturday and daylight savings is ending, which means an extra hour to party. But that's not going to happen this year. Here to lament with me and share some tips about making Halloween safe and festive is WESA's Kylie Kaczynski. Kylie, welcome back to Explainer.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
So what are we going to do to make Halloween feel Halloween-y this year?
Well, if the overwhelming sense of dread brought on by the state of the world doesn't scream spooky to you, I'm not sure what will. But obviously an indoor costume party, something most people do every year, wouldn't be a responsible choice to mark the holiday. I imagine we'll see plenty of costumes on Instagram, though, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website does list some tips about how to do Halloween broken down by risk level. A couple of ideas from the low-risk list are carving pumpkins at home with your household. They also have a sort of I Spy-style scavenger hunt idea for kids, so you'd walk through your neighborhood with a list of Halloween-themed things for kids to look out for. But then you have some moderate-risk activities like trick-or-treating, which the city just announced will go on this year.
Okay, so can you talk a little bit about the official guidance for trick-or-treating.
Yeah, so a lot of community Facebook groups rejoiced at the news that the city would endorse trick-or-treating, but the guidance includes a lot of the familiar prevention tactics. We're thinking cloth face masks, keeping your distance from other trick-or-treaters. They're urging folks to only go out with members of their household, so that would avoid large groups of people trick-or-treating together. The city suggests wearing a cloth face mask under your costume mask, but actually the CDC suggests ditching a costume mask altogether because doubling up on masks would cause trouble for some people. It would cause trouble breathing. A spokesman for the city didn't comment on that discrepancy, though. As far as folks passing out the candy, the city and the CDC are urging people to avoid close face-to-face interactions. So the advice is to leave a bowl of pre-wrapped candy or little treat bags at the end of a driveway or the edge of a yard or a stoop. And then you could watch the trick-or-treaters from afar, basically. It resembles maybe the grab-and-go style food events we've seen since the pandemic arrived.
What I'm planning to do, the bowl idea, I'm like a little less sold on because then you got every kid sticking their hands in the bowl, right? I'm planning to just put out a blanket and just like lay the candy out. That's my...
I think that's a good idea. You know, they could see what the candy options are and make the best selection, too.
There you go. Yeah, they're not, like, turning over every piece in the bowl to try and find, like, the last box of Nerds or whatever. What about stuff like hayrides and, like, pumpkin patch fall festival type things? Like, how do we gauge the risk around that?
So being outside is good, right? You know, you're not indoors, so there's more chance for the air to circulate. But hayrides are probably maybe in the medium risk category because you're closer to other people that might not be in your household. Pumpkin patches, you know, you're outside. You can avoid people from other households and stick to the group that you're going to the pumpkin patch with. So that's a pretty low risk activity.
I've also heard a lot of parents talking about, we're just going to take a day off and go during the week to sort of avoid those weekend crowds, which is probably a good idea.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Okay, so last question. What are you going to be for Halloween?
I'm a big Halloween person, but it's kind of hard to you know, go all out on a costume that no one might see. But I think I'll dress up even if I'm just sitting in my house watching scary movies. I like to try to do something from pop culture every year, and the British show Fleabag really made an impact, so maybe I'll dress as her. But I do think this is the last Halloween where the sinkhole bus is still a topical getup for people in Pittsburgh, so I would love to see other people do that because I'm not creative enough to create a whole sinkhole bus for myself.
It's interesting that you bring that up because this week in other news, 10th Street downtown reopened nearly a year after that bus fell into the sinkhole.
Liz, are you going to dress up as the sinkhole bus this year?
I am not. I am not. I don't have the time to be that creative. My kids, they are about 2.5, and they have chosen Itsy Bitsy Spider and Ghost this year. And so since they're going with that traditional spooky Halloween, I think I'm just going to be a standard witch. And try to scare my own children and as many of the neighborhood children as I see this year.
I hope you scare many, many children, Liz.
I literally have had parents mouth thank you to me while their kids are like trembling and coming to get candy. It's one of my favorite traditions. Kylie, thanks so much for being on Explainer this week.
Thanks, Liz. Happy Halloween.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.